Hello and welcome to The Fergan. My name is Dan and I'm here to try and make sense of these turbulent times from a heathen perspective. Visit fergan.com for links, information and an archive of past episodes. A book that I've recommended multiple times on the podcast and in Telegram posts is Arsitru, A Native European Spirituality by Stephen McNallan. In fact, when the book was first published, I was writing for an online publication called Heathen Harvest and was sent a copy of the book to review. So I'm honoured today to be joined by its author. It's good to speak with you, Steve, on this beautiful midsummer's day. How are you?
It is absolutely my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, no, you're very welcome. Yeah, we finally had the arrival of summer proper here in England. It's taken its time getting here. I'm sure in over where you are, it's generally quite sunny.
Well, it's been back and forth, though. We've had some really chilly days recently. Yeah. You know, at our gathering this last weekend, I was wearing my sweater and trying to get close to the fire at a couple of points.
Really?
Yeah, really.
Well, I've just had a fire today with my family. We lit a small bonfire and gathered around it and honored the sun, and it was far too warm. the space around the fire is not big enough to kind of escape its heat. So definitely unusually warm weather here in England. But actually, I wanted to ask you about the Odinshof Midsummer Meet. So how did that go?
It was definitely one of the best we've had. Attendance was just about all we could handle. I mean, you've seen the photograph of the place where we meet. Yeah. It's a former town hall sort of a place. It was never a church until we bought it. Now it is. And it's quite large, but you know, we were pretty much jammed full. I think we had probably in excess of 150 people, I would say. Mm. Lots of women, obviously. Lots of babies. Babies all the way from still nursing all the way up through, you know, from babyhood into childhood. Just loads and loads of young people. People mostly from the West Coast. We had a few visitors from other places in the country or up and down the West Coast, you know, up towards the Northwest and so forth. But yeah. Many of them were just people, you know, within the hour or two of where we held it.
Yeah, Steve was kind enough to send me a couple of photos of the meeting that they just had. And it's extremely impressive, not just to see the Hof itself, the building that they have acquired and turned into a heathen Hof, but the number of people there, a huge number of happy, healthy families, all looking extremely pleased to be there. It's not a surprise really, given what Steve has, do you mind if I call you Steve or Stephen?
No, Steve is fine.
Steve, good. Considering what Steve has built over the years, you know, many of the listeners will be familiar with Steve's work. I mean, for a very, very brief history for those who don't know, Steve founded the Arsitru Folk Assembly in 94, was it? 1994?
Oh, no, it was quite a while before that. Let's see.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
It's gone through a number of permutations. Mm-hmm. In the early 70s, it was the, quote, Viking Brotherhood. Mm-hmm. Because that was kind of where my development was at that point in time. You know, I was yeah, kind of new to all of this and very enthusiastic, but a little bit, narrow focused. And then it became the Arsitru Free Assembly for quite a number of years. And then eventually it became the Arsitru Folk Assembly. So it's been through its various evolutions.
It's been, yeah, big history. And obviously, I mean, you've not really slowed down at all. I mean, Your book, Arsatru, A Native European Spirituality, that was, about 7 or 8 years ago, was that? That came out?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, about that.
Yeah, and you're still busy. I gather you're still acquiring, the AFA in general is still acquiring new HOFs around the West Coast of America?
Well, not just the West Coast. We have a total of 4 HOFs right now. You know, Odin's HOF was first. Mm-hmm. And after that, we got a HOF in North Carolina, and we got one in Minnesota. And just a couple of weeks ago, we got one in Florida. And we're kind of prospecting around for number 5 at this point.
It's just incredible because, you know, heathenry is it's obviously not exclusive to North America. There are some very functional, very active groups elsewhere in my country, in England, in Scandinavia. I believe in the Netherlands. There are some active groups in Australia, even Tasmania, I believe, and certainly New Zealand and Canada. But as far as I know, no other nation has as many modern day HOFs as you do in America, in the USA there.
I think we're doing pretty well at that.
Yeah.
And all of the other HOFs, aside from Odin's HOF, all of them are former churches. Mm. There were Christian churches that were, you know, for sale. And so we scraped up the money we need. And so they're very presentable as a place of worship, perhaps more so than Odin's HOF is. Hmm. And they lend themselves to the conversion, so to speak, or the reconversion.
Depends,
I guess, on the time frame you want to be talking about.
Yeah.
They lend themselves well to that.
And so they've
got beautiful murals inside, thanks to the work of one of our people who is a wonderful artist and who is willing to travel from HOF to HOF to put in murals. And, of course, we have the ritual space inside and usually a ritual space outside as well. So,
yeah. Why do you think it is that you have succeeded in gaining 4, potentially 5 HOFs there when it seems to be so difficult in other countries? What is it that you about the AFA that makes that gives you that opportunity? Or is it just that you believe that you have a greater dedication perhaps than those in other countries?
Well, we're very dedicated, that's for sure. But I believe that people in all the other countries are dedicated as well. A lot of it is luck. A lot of it is the fact that we've been doing something, even if not quite on that high level, for a very long time. And so we've kind of had time to work out things like what it is we believe and what our particular customs and ways of being are within our organization. I stepped down from active leadership of the AFA a couple of years back and turned it over to a young man who has a youthful energy and he was a very good manager. Yeah. I think that I have some great strengths, but management is not necessarily one of them. And so it's thriving. It's absolutely thriving, and I'm thrilled with it.
And it's great to see, and it's particularly good to see that your members are not put off by the slander of the media and our ideological and sometimes spiritual opponents. And I think I'm seeing more of this now. I'm seeing people like myself and people in this country, people in America who are just kind of, there's a meme where there's kind of like you've got a group of people who are, and there's someone outside the circle pointing at them and shouting racist, and they're just kind of, they just carry on talking. I can't remember the exact wording of the meme, but obviously I don't consider myself a racist, and I know that you don't either. It's a misperception of what we do, of our folkish impetus, which people try to turn against us. But in especially in terms of the AFA, the people don't seem to be put off by this at all.
No, we're quite inured to it at this point, and we've heard all of the slander, we've heard all the slurs, they've called us all the names they could possibly call us, and it just rolls right off. Every now and then, some of our people get horribly doxxed by the left, who seek out the addresses and the employment places of people and proceed to make great trouble for their lives. But for example, the local newspaper, the Sacramento Bee, did a real slam piece on us a few months back. And of course, they'd made all these promises. Oh, we'll let you tell your story and blah, 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 and all the usual nonsense. But we gave it a shot. And of course, it came out horribly twisted. And so we go into YouTube and we're looking at the article, which was posted on the Sacramento Bee YouTube channel. And it was amazing looking at the comments. You know, 5 years ago, they would have been much more negative. But over and over and over, I'm seeing people saying, why can't white people have their religion too? I had a black guy, in the comments section says, I'm black. I like being around black people. You know, what's wrong with this? Yeah. I had a woman at our food giveaway program that we have for the local community. And we provide food to anyone who's hungry. We don't care about their race, their religion, or any other factors. You hungry? We've got some food. Come on by.
Yeah.
And there was one black lady who would come by every time, very faithfully, very nicely dressed, very, a nice way about her. And then came, a wave of slander. And at the next food giveaway, I see her drive up and she's kind of squirming in her seat a little bit. And I think, oh God, here it comes, and so she says, after a couple of squirms, she says, I understand people are saying you're racist because you only let white people into your church. I said, well, ma'am, it's an ancestral religion. So that's kind of the way it works for us. And she said, well, I don't think anybody's got any damn right telling you who you can let in your church.
Yeah.
And I thought, yes, somebody gets it. Somebody gets it. You know? And we had a 10-minute conversation about the revival of African-based religions in the United States. And she says, yes. I talk to my ancestors every week. You know, so I love it when some people get it. Get the fact that just because I love my people doesn't mean I hate anybody else.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been through 13 countries in Africa, for crying out loud, and numerous countries in Asia. I'm not some little provincial hick who doesn't like anyone who doesn't look like us.
I think I may be putting words in your mouth here, but I think you come from the same place that I do, which is, I got into the whole kind of folkish worldview through this idea that I genuinely believe in global multiculturalism, global multiracialism. I love the fact that you can travel this planet and see this myriad of beautiful different cultures, each having survived for sometimes thousands of years, different dress, different language, different phenotype, different customs, even different laws and things like that. And I think that's a wonderful thing because these things are tailor-made for the people that they spring from within. My crime seemingly is to apply the same standard to my own people. And that's really the long and the short of it is that we are expected to support global multiculturalism, but not when it comes to our people. But let's not get too much into this because I think everyone knows where we're coming from. I'm sure you've spoken on it many, many times. And our position on this makes so much sense that it shouldn't even need defending.
I'm ultimately an everybody nationalist.
Yeah.
Yeah. Everybody deserves the right to put their own people first, to be true to their people, to continue their people without interference from anyone else, be it a colonial power on the one hand or a new world order on the other.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah.
I mean, I have actively worked in northern India on behalf of Tibetans and not just Tibetans who are, spinning their prayer wheels and being all nice and nice for the tourists. I mean, I was talking with guys who had fought the Chinese, in the guerrilla war back in the 70s. And, I support the cause of the Tibetans actively. Yeah. I've literally walked through minefields with people of the Karen people in Burma, again, supporting them, maybe trying to help out here and there. So it's not like me or anybody else that I know or associate with are, you know, narrow-minded bigots. We really genuinely want diversity, and we want to keep diversity, which ultimately we would not have under a global authoritarian system.
No, and we'll get into that a bit later. But I just wanted to, because you've got so much experience, you know, previously having organized and led the AFA and other groups, I just wanted to talk about, you know, it's, quite a few people since this podcast began, the first two episodes were designed to be a very much a kind of beginner's introduction to heathenry and why someone might choose this path, what and how someone might make those first steps. And, you know, your book is part, this is why I recommend your book to so many people, because I think your book is an excellent, not just a beginner's, a beginner step, but an overview for people who have been practicing for a while. It gives a really comprehensive but easily understood and followed overview of why and how one might practice heathenry as a way of life. But you've got so much experience with this, and you know, I've got experience with, you know, meeting with heathens here in England, and people often ask, what's it like? And, you know, why is it so important to meet with other people? You know, I think I get the impression we have a lot of so-called lone wolves, a lot of lone practitioners out there, which is understandable because people are geographically isolated. And, you know, it can be difficult, especially in a country as big as America, to find someone within reasonable driving distance to practice with. But it is important, and I'm sure you agree with me there. What is it that you get out of it yourself, and why do you feel it's so important that we make the effort to meet in person at the high holy tides and to honor the gods together?
Well, when I first came to the gods, I thought I was the only person on the planet doing this. And I persevered, and I met more people, and I met more people, and then I met some more, and then we organized this and that and the other. And what we have now is, you know, a million times better than being just in isolation. I mean, who do you talk to about the things that are close to your heart if you don't have someone who understands all of these things that are going on inside you? And to take our most recent gathering, for example, the things that we did included baby namings. That's an immense thing, watching a young baby being brought into his or her clan and into this religious life, the spiritual life of the AFA. Now, hand fastings. Sheila and I did a hand fasting there. And it was, again, a invigorating affirmation of life. When you get together with a large group of people to honor the gods, to do bloat in whatever particular manner you do, there's something very special about standing with, you know, 100 plus other people. We had to make basically three spirals into our outdoor ritual area in order to get everyone in. And the strength of that was immense. There's some very interesting photos came out of it too, by the way, of, you know, lights where there shouldn't be any lights and things of that sort. So I don't know, we're picking up auras or beats me. I don't know how that stuff works, but the standing in a large group of people and calling upon the High One or calling upon Frigga, either way, it's not like doing an isolated ritual. It's not. I've done some great personal bloats. I've had some very fulfilling things happen just on an individual ritual. But when you're with others, you understand this is not just for individuals. In fact, Ausatru, heathenry, Odinism, whatever you want to call this thing of ours, it is made to be shared. It is about a folk. It is about a group of people. We're shoulder to shoulder and heart to heart and soul to soul when we do that. And it's just amazing.
It's I almost sometimes think of it as kind of this communal icebreaker, because you have, you know, I mean, and really that's what ritual is. It's taking you out of your kind of more conservative, you know, self-conscious daily self and putting you into a position where you by default are among people who think like you and who accept you and who you accept them. So, you know, you mentioned the baby naming ceremonies. All three of my children have been named at large gatherings, large heathen gatherings with at least 20 more or more people there. And you're surrounded by people who you may have only spoken to a couple of times, yet they're there drinking to your child. And that's not something that happens in normal day-to-day life. You know, you don't, you know, even the people that live in your town or village that you may say hello to every day, they're not going to stand up and drink to your child. Well, occasionally you might find a kind of, you know, a particularly nice local who would have that kind of attitude. But when you're participating in a heathen blot or ceremony or rite of some sort, there's an expectation placed upon everyone, and that expectation is received willingly by everyone. And so the ice is almost, it's broken by default. You're there. You know that you are going to express your allegiance to the people there, and that they are going to express their allegiance to you. And that's a rare thing to find in this day and age.
Absolutely. I mean, we live in an outer environment that is isolation, anomie, separation. The powers that be are happiest when we are isolated, yeah, when we don't have that contact with other humans. And in fact, that's something I'd like to talk about more later on, mm-hmm, is that connection as a way of, shall we say, defying the modern world.
Yeah, let's do it.
I have found our symbols to be very, very empowering as well. You know, basically, in the AFA, we have blots and we have symbols. And a symbol, for those out there who don't do that or haven't done that or not sure what that is, it is a ritualized drinking ceremony, at which it, by the way, it is very bad form to be inebriated. So we're not talking about, you know, this is not us sitting around the bar. Might do that at another time, but not in a symbol. At symbol, you need to be sober. You need to be focused. Different groups will have different ways of doing it. The way we doing it consists of three ritual rounds. The first is to the god or goddess of our choice. We get to hail them and you know, drink, and we all drink to hail Odin, hail Frigga, whatever. The second round is to one of your personal ancestors. You know, not some hero per se. You can do that on round three if you wish. But basically, someone related to you, someone in your family, someone of your heritage, you toast them. And people who are gone, people who are not in Midgard at this point. And then the third round is sort of whichever of the above. And you can toast someone who's present. You can toast someone you've known before. You can toast a deity again. There's any of a number of options there. But in every case, it is all of us together hailing our ancestors. It is all of us together hailing the holy powers. It is all of us sometimes sharing some very moving stories, as especially round three, where you know you sometimes learn of the pain or the suffering, as well as the joy, the ecstasy that people go through in their lives. So it is to me very, very, very rewarding, very, very rich.
Yeah. We practice symbol in a very similar way. I imagine that lots of groups around the world do it in that way. And you know, one of the great things about that, when you make an oath or you make some kind of promise during that that rite, you're doing it in front of people who take oaths and promises quite seriously. So it's a really good way of kind of collectively giving kind of a collective leg up to the folk present, because everyone is expected to make some kind of at certain rites, everyone is expected to make some kind of promise. To commit to something, and you're held to that. And then you may not see those people for, 3 months or something. And when you see them again, then you can speak about what you've achieved since then. There are so many positives to the kind of more mundane aspect of of moots and bloats, as we call them, moots. There are so many positive aspects to it, and I'm sure that you feel this too, but every time you go to one, you come away feeling absolutely recharged. I mean, you feel like you could take on the world when you come away from one of these things. All the people that you've shared stories with, that you have blotted with, who you have honored the gods with, the stories you've told, the information and knowledge that you shared with them, being able to speak freely about your beliefs and your worldview, and then you come away and you feel like you as I say, you feel like you can take on the world. So yeah, I would absolutely implore anyone who is just getting started with heathenry to try and find a local group. No, it doesn't matter how small it is, and it's okay to practice alone, but try and find a local group if there is one, you know. And it's common to drive an hour or more to meet with these groups. I mean, I personally drive 2 hours at least to meet with my group. So, you know, don't think that you're going to find one 5 minutes down the road. You're probably not. You have to make an effort for these things, but you will, you know, at least go to one and you'll find that it's worth it.
Yes, absolutely. The Sumble in particular is recharging and revitalizing. I mean, yeah. Blount is great and I love it. It's the core, but that conviviality that comes with sharing not just a horn of mead, but in fact, you know, deep feelings, deep emotions, deep concerns, life altering things. Yes, there's nothing that brings you closer to a person than that.
No, true. So, you know, these are the kind of mundane aspects of, you know, and I use the word mundane reluctantly, because there really is nothing mundane about meeting with your folk who, you know, who you share a heritage with and a worldview with, and who will often become some of the best friends that you can count on for life. But just to differentiate it from some of the other experiences that I've heard you talk about in past podcasts and interviews and things, we have the kind of the more supernatural or paranormal experiences, the more inexplicable ones. And I heard you on a recent podcast talking about a couple of these experiences. I mean, if you'd like to tell one or two of the stories, please feel free. But I'd like you to share whether these experiences, whether you see them as a kind of like a call, whether they felt like a call to this way of life, whether they affirmed your decision to have dedicated most of your life to doing what you do. You know, these experiences, is it a combination of the mundane, you know, the moots that you've been attending for years and organizing for years, a combination of that and the more kind of random, inexplicable experiences that you've had? You know, I've had some of my own, and for me, they very much have confirmed that I am on the right path, and that I'm not LARPing. I'm not, you know, I'm not, this isn't some kind of fantasy. This is a very real way of life, which our ancestors shared and perhaps in some way pulling us back towards through these inexplicable events.
I think it's all of that. It's all of that, with different emphasis perhaps on individual instances. Just to cite one thing, we did something we called the Gathering of the Tribes quite some years back, and we had a nice rural area, bit of acreage there with, you know, just very nice place to do it. You know, we had lots of trees and lots of brush, and it was very, very non-urban, shall we say. And one of the things that we did was to call upon the ancient tribes, the Heruli, Garmani, and so forth, over and over. You know, we called them forth, sought out their power, sought out their wisdom, so that we might be better at what we do. And it was, I think, a very good ceremony. I had noticed at one point, this was done at night, dusk, and I at one point it seemed like the earth was heaving, not in the sense of not this kind of a thing, like I was off balance, but almost waves, you know. And I I don't know. I've never experienced anything like that, so I have nothing to compare it with. Later, I had two other people come up to me and not knowing what I saw, told me that they had seen that as well. That was most interesting.
Yeah. I had that. Yeah. That's incredible. I had a similar kind of thing where, I was at a moot and we'd performed a blot, and it just so happened. I mean, we'd done this in the middle of a forest. It was quite late at night. We were camping over in the woods, and, a thunderstorm struck up around us. That in itself is kind of, you could put that down to coincidence. Although I don't think any of us at the time felt that it was coincidence. It definitely felt like there was some kind of divine intervention there. But later on we did some runic chanting, some visualization as a group. And I think there were about 10 of us there maybe that night. And we were focusing on a particular rune. I can't remember which rune it was, I'll admit, but we were asked to visualize the rune, to close our eyes. We were chanting the name of the rune. We did this for, you know, perhaps 5-10 minutes, and we were asked to describe what we visualized during this experience. And myself and one of my close kinsmen next to me had both visualized a snail shell, you know. And I just think, you know, it's a very small example, but I think it's an example of how these rites can bring the folk together in a very literal way. You almost start to think as one mind, and as in your experience, you start to perceive the your immediate surroundings in the same way, in the same unusual way. Perhaps, you know, you very much get the sense of the folk soul when you're in that sort of situation.
Yes, definitely, yeah. And also a connection with the world around you. Mm. We had one time when we were forming a local group, forming a kindred, as we call them, and the symbol of our kindred was the bear. California is kind of, you know, famous for the bears, and that's like our totem animal, so to speak, of the state. And we are in this area where we are. It's sort of semi-rural, but we were completely surrounded by houses, completely surrounded by, you know, artifacts of human construction. Although we had several acres that were quite nice. Well, the banner that we were consecrating with the bear on it, we had against a fence up there so that we could focus on that and use that for ritual purposes and so forth. And as we had just finished doing some sort of a service along those lines, a ritual action of various types, and somebody said, "Hey, there's a bear." And there was. A large bear had wandered into our area. I mean, we live in a mountainous area with nice forests, but again, we were surrounded by houses. And here, in this spot of acreage, isolated, and I don't think it dropped in by parachute, a bear had come out. And so, you know, all the guys go off to kind of look at it, but it just kind of went away, disappeared, whatever. But, you know, think about it. You know, in all my time in California, I've seen bears, say, 3 times in all these years. But there, at that point in time, within a couple of meters of the bear banner was the bear. And chances that are literally, you know, one in millions.
Yeah, I think you start to, when you follow this kind of spiritual way of life, the idea of coincidence starts to fall away. I think you start to think, you know, that so-called coincidences become too commonplace for you to put everything down to coincidence. And even when you've got quite an empirical mind, like I sort of naturally do have, luckily I've had enough experiences now to kind of disintegrate that sort of empirical way of viewing things. But I mean, to me, there's no doubt that what you experienced there is some kind of serendipitous sign, some kind of symbol. And these experiences, they only serve to reaffirm what we believe and to know that what we're doing is the correct way for our folk, for ourselves, for our family, and to bring more people into it. You know, when you've had these experiences, you kind of feel this need to help other people have these experiences too.
Actually, can I give you another instance involving bears?
Please, yeah, please do, Steve. Yeah,
I was home. See, I was here by myself. I don't know where Sheila was. She was off at something she had to go to, and I'd done just bloat right here in the house. I've got my personal altar up there behind me.
Yeah,
I had just done a rite that involved the bear as a symbol. Completed it almost immediately. I want to say 2 seconds, 5 seconds later, into the house comes running my cats. They'd been outside. It was dusk out, and they ran in highly alarmed. And I went over to the door, went out, looked out, and I saw a lumbering shadow of a bear crossing the driveway. I don't know, 100 feet away or something. You know.
So if you've had
thoughts on that, I don't know. I mean, that like I say, I've seen bears maybe 3 times in California. And two of those three were. Yeah. Synchronous, so to speak, with a spiritual act.
Yeah.
So maybe I've got a thing with bears. I don't know.
Yeah, I'd say you do. Yeah, definitely. So let's move on to the next topic of discussion that I wanted to get into. Steve wrote, it's probably a few months ago now, you wrote an article on your website. I believe it was called The Great Reset and the End of Humanity. Versus the Path of Odin. Is that the correct title?
I believe it is. Pretty close. There's kind of an issue with my website right now. It's being completely recast. And at this moment, as of today, it's not available, but it will be soon. And stevemcnallan.com. So okay. just saying, anybody who looks for it today probably is not going to find it.
No, well, I mean, this recording won't go out until a week after we've spoken. So hopefully that gives your,
yes, of
your guy enough time.
Hopefully by then I'll be squared away.
Yeah. I mean, I did actually go to the website or try to go to the website to check up on the title of the article so that I could quote it properly. But it was a really great little article. And I was really encouraged to see it because, Steve is someone who I've admired for many years. And to see someone like Steve who is taking up this fight, this battle that we've seen really come more to the fore over the last 2 years, with the whole agenda surrounding COVID and this idea of a great reset. So this article was kind of felt like Steve's declaration of his stance, his position, his stake in the ground, so to speak, in facing this challenge, which has really emerged into the kind of, the public arena over the last couple of years. So we've got this, by the time of this recording, the Pagan Futures event with Tom Rousell, Survive the Jive, will have taken place in London. I'll have been there performing a few songs between the speakers. And that conference basically seeks or sought to address this very question. But I wanted to speak to Steve in depth about this because I think you've probably got some really really insightful things to say about this, given your experience and how you've seen the kind of wider landscape change and how you feel heathenry or Arsitru needs to either adapt perhaps or take up the challenge against what we're seeing emerge with this great reset. So, would you mind kind of just reiterating your general sentiment that you were trying to express with that article and how you feel heathenry may be under threat, our beliefs may be under threat from this emerging kind of digital control system?
Well, let me preface my remarks by saying that I'm not anti-technology.
No.
I've been reading science fiction since I was 13 years old. So, and I wanted to go to the moon when I was much younger than that. So I'm not anti-technology at all. In fact, I believe that we have a future beyond this planet as well. Interstellar Lebensraum, baby.
that's something that you mention in many of your interviews. You know, you clearly have a real fondness for the idea of space travel. Perhaps not uniquely. There are others in the heathen community and the wider dissident community who put a lot of emphasis on this. But is that where it all goes back to? Is it literally back to your childhood dream of going to the moon? Is that why you still hold this kind of love of?
It's all very strange, really. The movie Destination Moon, which is a classic, came out in 1950. Either 51 or 53. I was born in 1948. So, and I distinctly recall pestering my poor sister to take me to see this movie. So I must have seen it at a very young age. And I don't know why I was so motivated to do that. I mean, I don't know. It's all kind of strange, really. But it's an interest that has never gone away. Even back in my later youth, when I was more obsessed with military things, you know, I was going to go in the army and go special forces and go fight commies somewhere, anywhere, which actually is still not a bad idea. No. But that said, it's been truly a lifelong interest with me. I mean, I have no illusions that I'm going to be traveling in space probably at my age, although that would be very nice if I could extend that enough to make that happen. Yeah. But I think it's that idea of going beyond that Nietzschean reach beyond the everyday, that desire to be more, to do more, to become more, become with a capital B in an Odinic sense. You know, Odin is the god of becoming in some ways. And it's always interested me. So I don't know. It's always been there. And yeah. In fact, for a while, the AFA had an aerospace technology guild, along with our meat making guild and our blah blah guild and our warrior guild and so forth. We had we launched rockets at the beginning of each major moot, you know, like the annual one or something, you know.
Right. Yeah. So, you really mean it when you say that you are not opposed to technology.
No, seriously. But I'm more attached to my individuality as a human being, in particular, a human being of my branch of the human race. But in general, just I don't want to become a non-human. And we're down a road that could quite quickly, actually, I think much sooner than most people think, lead us to that point. Once we get a brain-computer interface, and once that becomes kind of a thing, and so basically we're all, in one sense or another, online, quotes, one way or another, well, there's some problems with that. You know, anything that's online can be hacked. Will it be able to create new memories for us? Will it essentially destroy that person that we believe that we are? I think there's a lot of dangers there. So I'd say this not as a person who hates science and technology at all, but as a person who loves his humanity and who will not surrender it. I will not join the Borg.
No, and there's great emphasis in the heathen lore on the fact that we are organic beings. You know, I mean, obviously going right back to Althumbla and Asken Embla, Odin Villian Bay, and you know that we are not created. It's difficult to kind of discuss this because obviously we can't. The time that our mythology was written is a time pre-high technology. So there are no direct statements in the Eddas, for example, about the high technology which we have at our disposal in the modern day. So we are really left to interpret and to use our heathen gnosis, so to speak, as to how we should face up to this emerging high technology. And I think probably the real distinction that we should make is that to make sure that we always control technology rather than technology controlling us. I would argue that some people have become so addicted to their smartphones and things that they have almost come under the spell of this technology. But that is something which can still be overcome. It's not kind of systemic yet. But what we're seeing emerge with this whole transhumanist movement is the idea of kind of systemic, almost obligatory, control of technology over humanity and organic matter. And that's really the line that we don't want to be crossing.
I agree with you 100%. We are at a stage where we can destroy our humanity as such. I understand, people change, technology changes, things change. But I have my deep reservations about where that goes. One of the most important books I ever read, greatest influence on me, wasn't a book about Al-Satrud. It was a book called Four Arguments for the Elimination of Television. I read that back in the 80s, I guess it was. And for years, I didn't have a television at all. And I didn't miss it. And, mostly I wouldn't miss much about the one that's, back behind those doors that you see behind me in the video frame. I own a phone. Sometimes I even have it with me. I take it with me if I'm traveling by vehicle, so that in case of an emergency, I can do something.
I have the same policy.
I keep it in a Faraday bag when I'm not intending to use it, which makes me a bit of an anachronism. But preserving my humanity is more important than being able to find out what the hell my friends are thinking at any particular moment. I have thoughts in my own head. I don't need people putting their miscellaneous discussions in my head under most circumstances. If I want to know all of that, I will log in, go to my various social media and see what my friends are saying. And even that is something that I don't really wish to do more than maybe once a day. I guess I'm just an anachronism, but I've got a life to live. I don't want to live online. I don't want to live on the phone. I don't want to live on the television. I don't want to live a virtual life. I want a real life.
Our faith, it holds up this idea of heroism, and there is nothing heroic about dwelling in the metaverse. We're being told, we're being sold this idea of an easier, more comfortable, more almost more liberating in some ways life, to be able to log into this upcoming metaverse and be whoever you want to be. And, aside from the fact that there is no heroism in that, it also actually completely undermines our folkish sensibilities, because our belief is that you are who you are because of your ancestors. You are not a blank state, a slate, that you can't just, step into the metaverse and choose to be who you want to be. And once we disconnect ourselves to that extent, then, who is going to honor their ancestry when your ancestry is irrelevant to that extent? There is really nothing about this digital control system and this transhumanist system that's quickly emerging now. There's nothing about it which is in keeping with our heathen ways.
I couldn't have said it better. I completely agree with you. It's at best, if you step into the metaverse and you suddenly become the superhero that you envision, it's tawdry, it's cheap, it's stolen valor, it is stolen courage, it is stolen intelligence. It is a cop-out. And by doing that, you deprive yourself of the honor, of the acclaim that comes from getting off your ass and doing the things you need to do to change yourself. Friend of mine, deep friend of mine, Yost Turner, used to comment that change yourself and you will change thousands. I think that's true. But that personal change is something that each one of us has to face honestly. We have to be able to look ourselves in the mirror in the morning, not in the screen. We need to become something important. We need to become courageous. We need to become strong. We need to become attractive. We need to do all of those things in the real world. Hello, flesh, blood, you know, matter knocking on the table. And to retreat into that, first of all, it's a supreme cowardice. If you do it, you're a coward. Secondly, if you do that, you are appeasing and collaborating with an oppressive system that ultimately seeks to control you and everything you think, you and everything you do. Do not think for a moment that the metaverse comes without a price inside, a price in your soul. We must resist this, not just for our own sake, which is all I've ratted on about for the next minute or so, but not, as you've pointed out, you know, for our ancestry, for our descendants, for that which we can become, and for that which we are connected both in the past and in the times yet to come.
I think it goes even further than that, in the sense that opposing this control system, this oppressive system, is itself our opportunity for heroism. And a recent podcast episode that I did was called The Coming Battle. And in it, I, as concisely as I could, outlined the agenda for the 21st century, which is really the kind of public-facing manifesto that all of what we're experiencing is based upon. Alongside that, I actually quoted from your book, the noble virtues, the nine noble virtues, and the other various sets of virtues that have come from elsewhere, to point out that our very virtues that we have lived by for decades as Alsatru or heathens around the world, those virtues demand of us that we stand against this agenda for the 21st century, this transhumanist agenda, this coming world where we don't have any modicum of self-sufficiency, where land ownership becomes something that is we're dissuaded from quite strongly, where we don't have freedom of movement, where we can't even explore our own nation, let alone the wider world, where we cannot offer hospitality because we're being prevented by the rules of the moment from interacting with other human beings. You know, there's almost all of our heathen virtues, many of which are specific to our Alsatru and heathenry, as opposed to other religions, they demand of us that we do stand against this that's coming.
I completely agree. We need to realize that we live in a time where we are privileged to be heroic on a measure that has not existed in our lifetimes.
No.
You know, I understand, you know, men go to war and they do things that can be certainly legitimately called heroic, but never has there been a challenge like this. Never has there been a greater chance for fame, for undying fame, for glory.
Yeah. And as someone who's an ex-serving soldier, I believe, and who has obviously lived almost an entire life true to the gods, what is your view on Valhalla? You know, we have, obviously, our, strictly speaking, our law says that you must die in battle to reach Valhalla. My personal belief is that that is actually symbolic, and that any, and as I say, I'm talking about literal battle, actual fighting with your, either with a gun or with a sword. My personal belief is that is symbolic, and that any opportunity to show courage and bravery in the face of huge opposition, even if that is just intellectual bravery, that will be looked upon favorably by Woden or Odin. What's your view on that? Do you think it's symbolic, or do you think that you literally have to die with a gun or a sword in your hand to reach Valhalla?
I think that's symbolic. Certainly there's many ways to die, many ways to die honorably, saving someone else's life.
Yeah.
You know, woman's walking down the street, she gets attacked. You step in, you subdue the attacker,
yeah,
and take a mortal wound in the process. Certainly that is the sort of thing that, to me, yeah, you're there. You Valhalla, baby.
Okay, good.
But beyond that, I think that there are two roads. One is the road of the warrior, and that is where you master yourself and your skills and your highest ideals and put your life on the line and die for that and or for your comrades. But there is also the path of wisdom. Mm-hmm. This is the path of the runes. This is the path of imitating Odin. And ultimately, whether it's in battle or in the depths of our becoming our interior, still very valid. So I don't think it's a literal thing. I really don't. I mean, I know too many amazing people mm-hmm. who have overcome with a capital O in their lives so many times over. And there needs to be credit for that. And I believe that there is credit, because I don't think that Odin, may his name be honored, is that narrow-minded. I think he is broader than that. I think he is bigger than that. And I think we are to be bigger than that.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. So from that point of view, then, this, you know, as you said, this is the greatest challenge that we're facing in any of our lifetimes. This move to this push towards transhumanism, almost a transgenderism there. it's part of it, isn't it? I mean, that's really denying the kind of the basis of reality and of what humanity is. But this push towards that is the greatest challenge that any of us probably will ever face. And if anyone were looking for an opportunity to stake a claim to a seat at Odin's hall, this is it. This is your time to do it. And this is really how the Fergan came about, because, you know, I've held the views that I hold now for many, many years. But I didn't really see any particular need to become a spokesperson for them until the COVID agenda hit, which I saw it for what it was very, very quickly. And I said to myself, you know, to hell with it. This is, if I'm not going to speak out now publicly and loudly, then there's never going to be another time. So I've dedicated a lot of my free time over the last couple of years to this. And I think I'd like to see other people really relish this challenge, because it's actually a hugely empowering thing to be saying openly and clearly and without any hesitation, I am opposed to this because I hold these principles, I hold these values, and I am going to fight to the bitter end for those values. It can be frightening for people, but I think once you kind of break the seal and you step into that way of thinking, that way of being, it's very liberating. It's very empowering. And you find that a lot of people come to you privately to express the same views as well. And I'm sure, is that something that you've had? I mean, you know, firstly, do you feel the same way, that this is what we're facing now is a real opportunity for our folk?
Absolutely. You want heroism? You want a big struggle? You want a battle? You want a fight that can determine the future of our race and the human race? This is it. Mm-hmm. This is it. This is existential.
Yes. Yeah.
Those who want to control us, and if you want to know who they are, go to the World Economic Forum website. or their YouTube channel, better yet. They will tell you. They don't hide any of it. Listen to the experts, quotation marks, that they draw in. This Hariri fellow, the cybernetician or whatever he is, who talks about human existence is all about being happy, and we can do that. We can be happy all the time with, you know, these various interfaces, humanity altering things.
Yeah. The removal
that
of privacy.
Despicable.
Yeah.
We don't live for comfort. We don't live for pleasure. Nice as those things are, comfort's good, pleasure's good, but also it's good to be hard. It's also good to be strong. It's good to be obstinate in the face of the dehumanizing forces that are marching towards us even now. They want to put a chip in us, hook us all together. One think tank kind of person who had multiple contracts with, you know, RAND and probably CIA and all of those other outfits. I can't remember his name offhand, but he wrote a book called The Prometheus Project.
Yeah. Heard of it.
And it envisions that there's no other word to call it except the Borg. We are to become a collective organism. Well, everything I have to say to that would be really, really rude. I would have to go into a stream of profanity that I will not inflict upon your listeners.
Thank you, Steve. No, but very, very well and very strongly put there. Recently in the UK, we have the Ministry of Defence, a government department, have released a paper called Human Augmentation, where they're talking about the need to augment humans for future wars and battles. So it's they're not hiding any of this. It's not the realm of conspiracy theory. This is, they're very open in their own documents, and as I mentioned earlier, the agenda for the 21st century, that's an official UN document that was signed onto by 119 nations in the 20th century. They're not hiding any of this. There can be no doubt in our minds about what we're facing. Hariri, I forget his name, that you mentioned. I mean, the things he said, where he talks about removing privacy being a thing of the past, and the idea of the soul, you know, he's talking about reprogramming the soul and things like this. I mean, all of this is anathema to a heathen spiritual way of life.
Absolutely and emphatically, we must develop a culture of resistance against this.
Yeah,
I don't think that there is any way that we can be true to who we are in the long run and find a way to cooperate with this, to make heathendom function in a multi-cultural, multi-national form. We are organic. We are specific to our people, as are other groups around the planet. We collectively, anybody who gives a damn about their ancestors, and that goes to people on the other side of the earth as well, anybody who wants to stand up for their people, stand up for their ancestors, have a life that's fit for their descendants, needs to resist this. Even if it's just on a personal level. And there's 100 ways to do that. There's 100 ways to do that.
So in terms of solutions, I mean, your four HOFs that you have acquired with the AFA, I mean, it seems to me that they actually serve a very functional, important purpose, potentially in the future, as central rallying points for, if people find themselves pushed out of their home for some reason, or out of their job, or they're under threat in their local community, or they have been forbidden from, say, growing their own food or things like this, they've got somewhere to go where they know that they're going to have kinsmen there who have their back. What are some other, what do you think we need to be working towards? And not just as heathens, but anyone who is opposing this transhumanist, great reset agenda, what do you think that we need to be working towards post-haste at this point in time?
Well, I think that we need to be undercutting modernity. And by modernity, I don't mean the good things that we all enjoy, you know, living in a world where there are certain basic comforts. What I mean is that idea that that which is modern, that which is being developed, that which comes out of a laboratory or, oh, better yet, out of a think tank, better yet, best of all, out of the World Economic Forum, people who realize what that means and subvert it in their daily lives. Turning off your phone is a revolt against the modern world.
Yes, yeah.
Speaking to strangers on the subway is a revolt against the modern world.
Yeah.
There are so many ways that we can undercut this in our daily lives, and we cannot submit, not give up, defy their expectations.
Yeah.
Shut down your computer and take a walk in the woods. Be a human being.
Yeah.
Be a noble human being.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That is such simple first steps that you can take for anyone who thinks that this is an insurmountable challenge. Those are relatively easy to do, and anyone should be able to at least begin with those. And you can move on to things like, you know, having a small vegetable patch in your garden. That also is a revolt against the modern world. Homeschooling your children is a revolt against the modern world. You know, it moves up in stages and in increments. And not all of them are difficult to achieve. Many of them just take a momentary kind of direction of willpower. And really, if we're not able to muster that willpower, then all hope is lost. But luckily, there are many of us who are willing to do that. And your huge turnouts that you have at your moots, and, you know, the smaller but still significant turnouts that occur at the moots that I attend as well, these are people that are resolute. And I hope that most, if not all, of the people listening to this podcast will be sharing our view of what is to come and how to face it and which side of the line we stand upon. There are so many things we can do, and I mean, turning the telly off for an evening is another revolt against the modern world. Picking up a book instead of watching Netflix is a revolt against the modern world, and it's something we're all so capable of.
You know, I think if we sat down, if we just speaking to your listeners out there, if we sat down individually or collectively and made a list of the things that subvert this system that they wish to impose upon us, it would be long. You know, it wouldn't be 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 or 10 or 15 things. Yeah, I invite everyone to do this as a mental exercise. Take a piece of paper and a pencil. A piece of paper and a pencil, you know, one of those things. You know, no, it's not like a keyboard. Yeah. and just make a list. See what you can list in 5 minutes. How can you make a revolt against the modern world? That's what it's going to take, a culture of resistance.
Yeah.
And that certainly applies to heathendom, but it applies to everybody. You know, it applies to African nationalists. It applies to the Uyghurs, you know, sitting in the middle of Asia, if they can ever get out of the freaking prisons that they're in. You know, don't take this shit lying down.
No.
Rise up. Live your life. Live a full life, overflowing with connections with others, with love, with experiences, with laughter, with joy. Turn off the damn television. Go ahead, do it. I dare you.
Yeah. I mean, even just a genuine expression of joy is a revolt against the modern world.
Absolutely.
I'm convinced that our enemies in this battle, I'm convinced that they want to remove genuine joy. There'll be some kind of some kind of false simulacra copy of it, in, you know, some kind of dopamine hit that we experience in our new pod lives. I shouldn't talk about it as though it will happen. It won't happen, but this is what they want to happen. They want us living in symbolically, or perhaps even literally, in pods where we get this dopamine hit from whatever we're viewing on the screen or whatever we're consuming in the the poor quality genetically modified foods that they're serving us. And that will be the replacement for genuine real joy. So we need to seek out opportunities to find that real joy, that real human connection, and better still, a connection with the gods and ancestors. Because I think in some ways that is the ultimate expression of human connection. When you are so so keen to connect with your fellow man that you will go beyond the limits of time and space to do so, and you will connect with those who came before you and make an effort to connect with those who will come after you, you know, a cross-generational you know, human connection. So this is something that heathenry or Ausatru can really do for us, because it, more than any other religion that's prevalent within European lands, it is a deeply ancestral religion.
Expressing joy, expressing real emotions. Tell people you love them.
Yeah.
Tell your kids you love them. Tell your aged parents you love them.
Yeah.
You know, be a human being. Don't be a machine. Don't imitate the machine. It's like 2001: A Space Odyssey, or one of the series there, where you notice that Dave in the spaceship is becoming more and more machine-like himself, you know, and there's this conflict between him and the computer that doesn't want to shut down. You know, it's be a human being,
yeah.
Move forward, make connections. You know, I try to remind myself of that. I get all busy, you know, and, oh, I don't have time to do this or that. But no, I'm going to get on the phone. I'm going to call my brother in Texas, or, you know, and other relatives I've got. And, you know, call up my hugely individualist and very bright son, and and see what his latest revolt against the modern world is. He's doing a pretty good job of that, actually.
Has he, if you don't mind me asking, has he followed in your footsteps? Is he a heathen, or does he at least share, you know, part of your worldview?
Not really. Well, let me rephrase that. I don't think he has any deep spirituality. I think he's pretty much a materialist, or at least that's what he lets on. But he's not exactly Mr. Emotive, so it's kind of hard to tell. But he is very much off the system as much as he can get. Absolutely guards his privacy. He's a total computer whiz, so he can do a very much better job of that than I ever could. You know, I'm sure that my string of data in the various and sundry repositories of the government are probably growing every day. But no, he's below the radar. He's very independent. I was very happy to see that when I went over to visit him at one point during the whole COVID thing, walk into his house and he's got his Glock pistol on his hip. And I think, yes, you know, we can do that sort of thing over here.
Yeah.
sorry, guys.
Yeah.
Y'all need to do something about that, really.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure how, but I agree.
I don't either.
Ideally. I mean, there are
not your fault, I know.
No, there are still ways that you can set yourself up for self-defense over here. Not quite as obviously, but yeah, it's. I mean, I've got three young children. The eldest of mine just turned 9, and it does. I feel like my wife and I are doing the right thing so far. We've homeschooled them since the very beginning. My wife is very good with foraging and identifying plants and herbs and fungi and things like that. So my children know, they're better than I am at identifying herbs and plants at quite a young age. So I think they're on the right course, but they're in for a hell of a future. You know, I mean, it sometimes saddens my wife and I to think about all of the kind of carefree experiences we had in our, you know, teens and our 20s. And, you know, I'm in my late 30s now. And We you know, all these experiences, traveling to other countries to go to music festivals and things like that. These things which our children probably won't experience, certainly not in the same way, but they will have different meaningful experiences. And I would say that their experiences will probably be more meaningful than ours, out of necessity, really. And I think maybe your son will find, you know, I'm sure he's a good man, but maybe he may even find that the coming years kind of, you know, even shift his worldview a little bit, as it will probably all of ours.
I think that as time goes by in life, you get to realize that things are not as simple as matter and energy.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's more to things than that.
Yeah, exactly.
And actually, I think there's probably stuff going on in deep physics that would verify that, or that would back up that sort of a conclusion.
Yeah. So is there anything else you wanted to get into? Any other points that you wanted to make in this talk?
I just want to say again how important it is to seek other people out and to have that human contact in heathendom, by whatever name we call it, you know, that this thing of ours, our native faith, our ancestral faith. Yeah, seek folks out for all the practical reasons that we could certainly touch upon, things like survival if the economy continues. I mean, over here in the States, I mean, it's looking bad.
Yeah.
I don't see a good outcome to the social political situation. My speculation is, this is just Steve, yeah, mm-hmm. I believe that it's being deliberately made bad.
Oh yeah, I absolutely share your belief in that, Steve. Yeah,
putting us under stress. Yeah. The powers that be, and Joe Biden is not running this country. I mean, I think anybody who watches him speak can see that.
Yeah.
And so I won't get too political, but I will just say that I think the system is probably going to lighten up with a little bit for the next couple of months. And then I think we'll see some false flags and we'll see some lockdowns and there'll be some unpleasantries. And maybe I'm wrong. I hope I'm wrong. But that just looking at least at the U.S., that's the kind of stuff we're looking for. We have a nasty bunch in Washington.
I think it's looking very much the same here. I mean, inflation, the cost of food and fuel just keeps on rising. The very infrastructure over here, you know, getting people to come and do, you know, work on your house that you're not able to do on your own, things like that. All of that has become more and more difficult as well. It should be obvious to anyone by now that you should have a store of, you know, of dried foods, tins and things like that, as much as you can, as you have space for and that you can keep. The survival of our folk is dependent upon being prepared for these things.
Yes, and that's the nice thing about organized heathenry or Ausatru or Odinism, is that it gives you extended family real quick. It gives you people with different skills. You know, we've got some, you know, young lads that are really good at medical stuff, for example, and other people that are really good at putting food by, and people with other skills. It's good to stay tight with people you can trust.
Yeah.
So again, you know, if you're a lone practitioner, well, you know, there's nothing wrong with that in itself. I get that. But at the same time, consider that traditionally ours has been a spirituality, a religion that emphasizes contact with kin. And that can be blood kin or it can be troth kin. Any way you want to look at it. So we need to stay tight with each other. We need to do the logical and necessary things, take care of ourselves, be prepared for anything that comes, stay connected with each other, and give it our very best, because so much depends on our success. So much depends on it. You know, the foes, the people who want us, their slaves, tell us that, you know, we will own nothing and we will be happy. Well, to hell with them. We ain't playing that game.
No, we're not. And, you know, the obvious question to that is, well, who's going to own that stuff then? Because someone has to own it. So there's no doubt about what we're facing, but with what you've built and what so many of us are building around the world as heathen communities, but as also as non-heathen communities, I'm very hopeful. I don't believe for a moment that we won't win this, but we're going to see some interesting and perhaps difficult times before that final victory comes.
Well, I think so. And just as a couple of points before we sign off here, whatever, I want to add that people who want to get my book don't have to order it from Amazon. They can contact me directly, Wolf Age Media, all run together, lowercase, wolfagemedia@gmail.com. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. I've got a Proton mail address too. Maybe we'll pop that out at some point. Mm-hmm. But you know, you can get one from me. Just drop us a line. We'll tell you all about it, and it'll be autographed if that helps. Which will either get you great acclaim and be worth $1,000 for a copy, or it could get you called up before a grand jury.
Well, luckily my copy's not signed, so I'm okay then, right?
Hey, you're clean, man. You're clean. It's all good.
But no, I mean, I'm not just saying this because I'm speaking to Steve at all, but it really is a very good book, particularly for people who are quite new to heathenry and the, you know, the Germanic heathen tradition. It really is an excellent all rounder, I would say. So I would definitely encourage people to pick up a copy if they can.
Well, people can find me on MeWe. They can find me on VK. They can find me on Gab. I've even got a Twitter account, which I kind of tone things down a little bit and calm down. Yeah. But, you know, I'm out there, and anybody who's interested in what I do or anything, by all means, find me. Wotan Network, I should say, just to keep it old school. Wotan Network is one of my projects, if any of you have run across that. And I have group membership on various social media. The AFA can be reached at runestone.org. Oh, what else did I need to tell you? Oh, if you want to see what Odinshof is doing, this is just kind of a brag more than anything else. Drop in at odinshof.org and you'll see all the pictures from our latest gathering and all that kind of good stuff. And
oh, great, yeah.
You get a taste of how good it can be.
Well, I hope that we can see these Hofs springing up across the world, not just across America. Obviously, we have one in England. Which I've not actually visited myself, but it's also a converted church and I've heard very good things about it. I don't know about elsewhere, but I think the thing in America is that you have, because of the space and perhaps in rural areas, I think property can perhaps be a bit cheaper. So it's a bit more feasible for heathens to pull money together and buy these places, not to take away from the dedication that, you know, your members and your fellow kin over there obviously have. Here in England, where property is prohibitively expensive almost everywhere, it's difficult to find these kinds of things. But, well, who knows? I mean, maybe if the things that Steve and I have talked about with the change of the kind of economic situation happen over the next few years, who knows what might happen to property prices? Maybe we might find some kind of silver linings in the kind of future turmoil.
Could be. I mean, it, many things are going to happen. And so all of those things will not be bad. Some of them will be opportunities.
Yeah.
So stay alert, protect yourself from the bad ones, but keep an eye out for any golden opportunities to come along. And that happens too.
Yeah, there will be many opportunities. But no, it's been a real honor to speak with you, Steve. And thank you for giving us your time. And thank you very much. And thank you, everyone, for listening. And be well. Much through hell.
And you as well. Thank you so much for having me on. Honor and victory to all here.
Well, I hope you enjoyed listening to that conversation as much as I enjoyed having it. To finish off this episode, I shall read from the Exeter Riddle Book. The answer to last week's riddle is apparently J, as in the J-bird. Doesn't seem to be unanimously agreed upon, but fairly widely agreed upon as the most likely answer to that one. So, yeah, I mean, that's not something that I would have known myself. I think you'd have to have a good knowledge of the avian species to get that one. But for this episode of the podcast, riddle number 9 is as follows. In former days, my mother and father forsook me for dead, for the fullness of life was not yet within me.
but another woman graciously fitted me out in soft garments, as kind to me as to her own children, tended and took me under her wing, until under shelter, unlike her kin, I matured as a mighty bird, as was my fate. My guardian then fed me until I could fly, and could wander more widely on my excursions. She had the less of her own sons and daughters by what she did thus. Once again, thank you very much for listening, and particularly to those of you who support this podcast. Please visit fergan.com if you'd like to know more about how to do that. And as always, be well until I speak to you again.